Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, March 4th, 2026. Present today, we have Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Representative Allard, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp, Representative Galvin, Representative Hannon, myself, Co-Chair Shragi, Co-Chair Foster. I believe Co-Chair Josephson is at a bill hearing and should be joining us shortly. If I could ask members to please mute their cell phones if that has not been done so already. Also present today, we have our House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. And we also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office. Thank you for being with us to help us with our work here today. In today's meeting, we will hear two presentations. The first will be a presentation on the Governor's February 18th budget amendments and an updated fiscal summary by the Legislative Finance Division. Then we will again take up HB 280, Apportionment of Taxable Income, Highly Digitized Business. With us today from the Legislative Finance Division is Alexi Painter, Legislative Analyst. Mr. Painter, if you could please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation, which we have pulled up in front of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. So the first slide is an updated fiscal summary of the governor's amended budget with the most recent amendments. This is still based on the fall revenue forecast. And you've heard presentation of this of the amendments we've gotten since then from the Office of Management and Budget, so I'll just kind of recap where that puts us fiscally. So in FY26, the we have had three rounds of supplemental requests from the governor. We have a starting deficit of $51.1 million based on the fall revenue forecast, and then these three rounds of supplemental requests that get to a total deficit of $336.8 million. That does not include the $129.6 million proposed transfer in the governor's supplementals to the higher education fund, because that's not deficit spending, it's a fund transfer internal between two funds. Excuse me. So the total CBR draw in the governor's supplementals would be $466.4 million based on his supplementals that he's submitted so far, plus the $55 million for fire suppression that they're counting but haven't formally submitted to the legislature. I would note that the version of that of the supplemental bill that this body passed did not include those February 17th amendments. The other body has added those into the version that's going on their floor, I think, on Monday. I think it was in second reading today, but we'll be back on next week. So the other body's version is pretty similar to the governor's supplementals. It includes an additional $35 million for disaster relief, conditional on us not succeeding in our appeal on the match percentage for Typhoon Halong. And then it omits a couple of items as well, but it gets to about a $500 million CBR draw in the other body's version based on the version that's going to the floor.
Representative Hannon.
Mr. Co-Chair, my slide on page 2 does not match the slide on the screen. If we jump all the way over to the far right column, I'm at 28.4% as opposed to 30%, and I'm just hoping that we could reconcile those so that I am looking at the same numbers that Mr. Painter is going through.
Are you aware of the issue and are able to speak to it now? Yes. Director Painter.
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, there was a corrected version that I sent out this morning, and I think in members' packet, you may have the old prior version.
Okay, so the corrected version is the one on screen.
Yes. Director Painter, very good. All right.
Where is that?
We'll take a brief at ease. Brief at ease. All right, back on the record. Director Painter, I think we've worked out the issues. We've got an updated slide in front of us. Members' packets have an outdated slide. We're working on getting copies distributed for two members, but members are comfortable just working off of what we have on screen for the moment so we can keep rolling.
Okay.
Were there additional questions or comments on this slide from members?
Okay.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I would ask if Mr. Painter could please verify what you said earlier with regard to the higher education fund, the $129.6 million, whether it's included on the other bodies' supplementals, or rather the transfer, the post-transfer deficit numbers.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So the governor's version, it's a direct transfer from the Constitutional Budget Reserve to the Higher Education Fund, so it shows up as a fund transfer and doesn't add to the deficit. In the version of the bill that this body passed and that is in front of the other body, it goes through the general fund. So it's a transfer from the general fund to the Higher Education Fund. So in that version, it does add to the deficit. It nets to the same thing, but it just displays a little differently on a fiscal summary.
Follow up.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Just for the record, my understanding that 129.6 currently sits in the CBR. That would presumably be moved to the higher education fund. The CBR fund, as I understand it, currently is averaging about 3% interest, and the higher ed fund is averaging roughly 7% interest. First of all, is that correct?
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, those are the targeted balances. I think both have been a little higher recently, but that's
okay, so a difference of roughly 4%. And just for the record, I want to make sure that we're all aware, that means over $400,000 per month that we're leaving on the table, and because we're missing out on that revenue, should it be into the higher ed fund doing the work that it needs to be doing, every month that we delay this, as I understand it, is in the order of $400,000 of lost revenue, or roughly about $5 million per year. So I just wanted to make sure that that's something that we're aware of as we're making these very, you know, difficult decisions when it comes to getting enough votes in order to move funds from the CBR, which is a lower interest rate, into the higher ed fund, which is a much higher interest rate. And that will make a difference with regard to how much we're eating into that fund or keeping it solvent as we are using it more and more. Thank you.
Okay, and we've been joined by Representative Jimmy at 142. Welcome. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi, through the chair. And with regard to Representative Galvin's comments, is it possible for us to get a better handle on what it would take if we decided as a legislative body to, and a finance committee, to restore and make whole the lost opportunity for that? I think that's something that obviously we can look at as we move into the next budget, or into this budget cycle, of restoring what was lost. And then I just want clarification, if it's possible, on that number. I heard the number $400,000 per day. Seems high a month. Okay. So clarity, we got it per month.
Yeah.
But is that something that you guys would be able to provide to us, just so we have that in front of us when we're going through our deliberation on the 27 budget?
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes, we could provide that. And one thing I noticed, when the balance of the higher education fund was swept to the CBR a few years ago because of the failure of the reverse sweep vote, and then was restored the subsequent year by legislation that moved that fund out of the general fund so it's no longer sweepable. The legislature, when it recreated the fund, included essentially an amount for lost investment earnings, and the governor vetoed that additional amount. So we're sort of never caught up to that impact of the sweep from that year, but we can certainly calculate what the impact would be this year between September and whenever it actually gets restored.
Representative Stapp?
I'm going to pass to later, Co-Chair.
All right, very good. And Director Painter, this, I would just note, relies on the fall revenue forecast. And while we have some trends in oil price, which I think you'll speak to here shortly, they're rather volatile or unreliable looking into the next year, but in terms of the current fiscal year that we're in, we can expect that to have some impact on the projected deficit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes. So I have a future slide about this, so if you don't mind, I'll hold off until I get to that slide to talk more about the impact of what a spring forecast might look like.
Okay, please continue, Director Payne.
Okay, so turning to FY27, I'll note a couple of things here. So first is that agency operations are a little bit higher, as is the capital budget from the previous fiscal summary. When I presented to you back in January, I noted that the average during this governor's tenure of the governor's amended budget is a $103 million increase from his original December budget, and this year he was almost exactly at that. So pretty much an average difference. We still expect future amendments from the governor, I would note. There's likely next week we will see more amendments that will include salary adjustments for additional bargaining units. There's two outstanding bargaining units that have come to agreements, and we expect to see that in amendments. So we will see some additional items going forward. But again, where we are now, we're at that about $100 million added. And so that means that the $1.5 billion deficit we talked about before is now a $1.6 billion deficit with the added $100 million of amendments. So at this point, for the Constitutional Budget Reserve, that would draw us to an estimated balance of a bit over $1.4 billion. Currently, it's at about $3.3 billion in terms of the likely spendable balance. The cash balance is a little bit lower at about $3 billion. And I would also point out, and I'll have the numbers a little more on the next slide, that this fall revenue forecast number is not what DOR shows as the fall revenue forecast. We have two legislative finance revenue adjustments. One is one that you should be familiar with because we've discussed it a couple of times, that for the NPRA revenue. The fall revenue forecast treats that as unrestricted general fund revenue or a portion of it as that. Based on advice from legislative legal, Ledge Finance continues to treat that as federal revenue, so that's a $9.6 million difference. The other difference is we have a revenue adjustment for a few instances where the governor's proposed budget is spending general fund program receipt revenue in the budget that otherwise would lapse. So he has increments or fund source changes to utilize this general fund program receipt revenue that otherwise would lapse to the general fund as UGF revenue. And in the past, the Department of Revenue did not necessarily account for program receipt revenue that's lapsing very rigorously in their revenue forecast. This year, they did a lot of work to try to true that number up. I think it ended up increasing the revenue forecast by about $30 million. But that does mean that when you're spending money that would otherwise lapse, it does count. It impacts the deficit just the same as spending UGF. And so, you know, an example of that would be in the governor's budget, he's proposing to spend $4.2 million in the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development of business license receipts. Currently, those business licensing receipts all lapse to the general fund. So spending them as business license receipts counts as designated general fund because they are a program receipt. But they impact the deficit just the same as spending UGF because right now those are counted in the revenue forecast as UGF revenue. And so we want to make sure that, you know, the legislature, if they choose to spend UGF instead or if they choose to not do that, that the true deficit impact is counted. And so we'll keep tracking those items. It's about a $10.5 million adjustment for several of those items that we have included right now. And that's really just aimed at trying to get that budget transparency that spending DGF that otherwise would lapse really is identical fiscally from spending UGF.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you. Co-Chair Strage through the chair. Director Painter, thank you. That particular issue that we talk about was in subcommittee. Specifically, we were talking a little bit about this from the department and how those funds are basically put in through to the general fund, and then we redirect those dollars kind of back to the department. I was just wanting, and maybe we don't need an answer for that today, but if there could be an answer given to the committee on how we can, if there's any measures we can take to prevent or to change how we are doing that so that we aren't basically creating the situation you were just describing.
Director Painter.
Through the Chair, Representative Bynum. So back in 2011, the Legislative Finance Division and the co-chairs of the finance committees on both bodies did what's called the Budget Clarification Project. Part of that was to deactivate a series of fund codes that really could only be used for things like that, where you're redirecting revenue. And an example of that was the business licensing fund code. We deactivated that fund code at the time based on transparency that really you should never be spending that outside the program that's collecting it by statute, so there's no reason to separately account for that source. And so the department is seeking to reactivate a fund code that we deactivated 15 years ago. And so our solution would be to kind of stick to the guidance that we collectively, you know, I mean, I wasn't there, but those, I don't think anybody in this room was part of the legislature then, but that the bodies kind of collectively agreed to in 2011 on the Budget Clarification Project to try to avoid that situation. And it was a very large effort and kind of dramatically changed the fund codes. And a lot of the principles there were to avoid this sort of untransparent spending.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through Co-Chair Shragi, just for clarification, I want to make sure that we have on record that when we closed out, for example, in DCCED, this very example that you've been hearing about, the $4.2 million, which was at the time using an old code that it was using DGF money in order to support the work that they wanted to do, what we did, and that was, you know, thinking through the advice that we were receiving from Legislative Finance Division, is we went ahead and shifted it to UGF, what it truly is. And then in this case, we also cut it in half so that we can better track what's going on. Instead of it being $4.2 million, it's $2.1, and then the rest is going to lapse into UGF. So I just wanted to share that the end of that story, at least, is how we've chosen to move forward. And my understanding is the department is pleased with this direction, in moving in the right direction for the work that they would like to do with regard to licensing and investigators.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Shragi. Because I'm not on that subcommittee, but my question is on that point, and I didn't know that the subcommittee had rolled it to UGF, but Mr. Painter, are we putting enough money into this idea of the licensing boards covering the investigation costs? Because previously we had all licensures had to cover their own investigation, and we, you know, one of the concerns as we've gone to more multi-state compacts, we have fewer licensees. The investigation cost doesn't really change if you have a bad actor, but you've got fewer people paying the license fee in Alaska by them being part of a multi-state compact. And I think DCCED was showing some leadership and vision of making sure we're not burdening fewer number of licensees licensed in the state with a potential huge investigation cost. And it was a $4.2 million item coming out of these lapsing receipts. Do we generally, is that enough money to cover the investigation costs that we generally see, whether it's coming directly from UGF or from lapsing receipts? For tracking, one may be easier to track than the other.
Director Painter.
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, I think it's really just a policy call if you'd like to do that. The statute suggests that the licensing fees should cover the entire cost of including investigations, and specifically in the statute, the legislature can appropriate funds as you see fit. And if you would like to do the entire cost of investigations as the department requested, you can. If you'd like to partially offset it, you can as well. It's a policy call. I don't have any real advice on that.
Quick follow-up.
To the specificity, do you think $4.2 million covers the cost of the investigations that we see on an annual basis?
Director Painter.
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, that's what the department has stated. I can't independently verify that beyond the department's own assertions.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Shragi, to Director Painter. I don't quite understand what the purpose of what is happening, Director Painter? I mean, I don't see any material difference between using a fund receipts source that would otherwise lapse into the general fund and passing a bill that uses court filing fees to give to somebody when that money also would otherwise lapse in the general fund. So I don't, why would we clean one up and not the other? Through the chair.
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, if that bill passed, we would do a revenue adjustment until the revenue, until the Department of Revenue has a chance to update the revenue forecast accordingly. So, you know, because these are now being tracked more rigorously, we're sort of trying to also track it in our fiscal summaries more rigorously. But I know in the past, you know, going back 7-8 years ago when there was massive changes to start utilizing more program receipts in the budget, we did include revenue adjustments because, again, we're trying to accurately portray the cost of legislative action. So that bill would be an example where it does reduce UGF revenue by converting it to DGF, and it should get a revenue adjustment.
I follow, Mr. Kocher.
Follow?
Yeah. Why not just take all the fees, the DGF, deposit them into the general fund, and then distribute them out that way so you can see the total cost of all the programs? So right now you have DGF that is used for a purpose, and then excess lapses into the general fund. Why not do it that way through the chair?
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So kind of gets to why do we even spend DGF, right? That's the purpose of that, I suppose, is to try to connect the revenue generation of certain programs. So you can see that the Department of Motor Vehicles or Division of Motor Vehicles, for example, is entirely supported by fees. Their fees are higher than the cost of their agency. You could argue that the fees are so far in the cost above the cost of their agency that it should all just be UGF, but that would be a policy choice for the legislature to budget them differently. You know, is there a particular reason that DMV that generates, I think, $35 million of UGF revenue is treated differently than the Department of Revenue that, you know, spends as UGF and then collects $1.4 billion of revenue? That's really just how the legislature and governor have chosen to build the budget. And to give a micro example, one of the revenue adjustments we have is for is specifically to charitable gaming receipts, where that's the only receipt that the Department of Revenue spends as program receipts is from charitable gaming. Every other receipt that they collect, they don't spend as program receipts. Why is that one special? Because the legislature set it up that way. It's a policy choice that you all can change if you'd like.
Cool. Got a follow-up?
Cool. Quick follow-up.
I like talking about things we can just change, right? Because I think it's a good point to put on the record that, like, there's a lot of times, Chair Schrage, there's no real rhyme or reason why we're so kind of inconsistent with how we do these things. So it's good that you said that, Director Painter. My follow-up, though, because I am going somewhere of some material importance as I try to collect my thought again here, would be why. Yeah, so to the point about designating a general fund, like what is the amount of money that we collect in these fund sources that ultimately lapse in a general fund? Like, do we have a broad kind of thought number on that through the chair?
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I'd have to look at the revenue sources book. It's broken up into a few categories where there's DMV receipts are one category because that's so large, and then there's a couple like charitable gaming that are, you know, lined out. And then there's others that are just go under this roll-up of charges for services. I know the delta when they did the reanalysis was like $30 million, but that included movement in both directions. And I don't remember the total right now off the top of my head. I can get back to the committee with that number.
Okay. Follow-up?
Sure, through the co-chair. I wasn't going to ask it, but I'm going to roll here, so might as well, right?
Get it out of our system.
Yeah. That cruise ship head tax fee we got in the RSB that's got some sort of restrictions are. And I don't know if you know what the top of your head restrictions are, but at some point I would like to better understand, I think, that better, if you could give me that in writing or not through the chair.
All right. And just a quick question from me. You mentioned that we expect additional supplementals for or amendments for fiscal year 27. And you talked about how in the other body they've rolled in the amendments that we've received so far for fiscal year 26. Do we expect much more from your perspective for fiscal year 26, or do we have a high degree of certainty around that at this point?
Mr. Chairman, I think the most likely items that we will see for FY26 are additional judgments and settlements. Those tend to roll in as the year goes on. Right now, we have only two very small ones. For example, we know, and at this rate, I'm not even going to have to show my other slides because these are the things on my future slides, but for example, we know that there was a SNAP penalty stemming from FY24 performance. The department has appealed that. It's likely that we will have to pay at least a portion of that, and similar to last year where it was split between new investment projects and a payment to the federal government, it's likely that that will come in at some point, perhaps in a reduced amount if our appeal is successful, but I think that's a $4.6 million item right now. And then unknown other judgments and settlements, that's the most likely items, but I think, you know, we never know all the items until they're agreed to by the governor, so we'll have a much better idea when we see the next round of amendments. But those are the two items that we frequently see later in the process.
Okay. Since we've spent so much time on this first slide, why don't we see how quickly we can get through the next few. Director Painter.
Mr. Chairman, so I've already talked about all the items on this slide. These are some of the notes on the fiscal summary. This is just writing them down about the $129.6 million and then the revenue adjustments. So no time needed on this slide. Then the next is potential future items. We've already talked about a few of those. So there's still five bargaining units that are negotiating cost of living amounts for FY27. We're expecting two of those in the amendments we get next week, and hopefully the remainder in a future round of amendments. Statutorily, those are due on day 60, but often they come in a bit later. Then the SNAP penalty, as I mentioned. There's also two items that are sort of outstanding that could impact the budget, but are unknown. One is the federal K-12 disparity test, where our appeal for FY26 is still pending. And then, as you heard yesterday, we still don't have a federal grant application yet for the Alaska Marine Highway. It sounds like there's progress on that, and we may see that application later this month. But then the actual amount and timing is still unknown. So those are two items that are not really action items, but just potential future items to keep on your radar.
Not seeing any questions. Representative Moore?
Oh, no,
question?
Sorry.
Okay,
no,
just a false flag there.
Sorry.
Okay. Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrage, through the chair, Director Painter. You know, obviously we've been talking a little bit about this issue with the disparity test and failure of the disparity test, and I'm assuming we will have some level of strategy to be able to try to address that, assuming that the appeal is not successful. But leading up to that, is there any recommendation from your department on how we should be dealing with that currently?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I think the way that the constitutional budget reserve language has been drafted in both bodies' finance committees addresses the potential risk for FY26 by covering explicitly any appropriation made last year, and that include the K-12 formula at whatever amount. So whether we pass or fail the disparity test, that's covered. I think language like that resolves any potential issue in FY26. And for FY27, there's not really an issue until we fail, which I think we probably have a pretty good shot of succeeding, but we wouldn't know that until too late. There's not really any action needed that could be dealt with in the supplemental next year if we do fail. So I think that CBR language that applies to anything in a bill insulates you against any potential issues for the current fiscal year, whereas the governor's proposed CBR language that was capped at a given dollar amount does not insulate you against those things. So I think the way it was rewritten in both finance committees resolves that issue.
Representative Bynum?
Thank you, through the chair. So if my memory serves me correctly, though, in the FY26 budget, the CBR did fail. So given the failure of that vote in the original budget and it's not being currently passed in a supplemental budget, where does that leave us now?
Director Painter?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, you could look at the existing $51.1 million as potentially $78 million higher,
yeah,
or potentially not.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, going on to the oil price update. And so the The fall revenue forecast had a forecast price for FY26 of $65.48 and a FY27 price of $62 per barrel. In the blue line, you can see, dating back to January 1st of last year, the actual prices, and the red line is where the fall forecast kind of kicks in with their price for the rest of the year. And you can see that the prices have started rising in about when the Venezuela operation happened in January, and continued to rise after the Iran operation last weekend. And so we're now looking at a higher price, but the price to date through Monday for FY26 is $67.40. So any higher price has to deal with the fact that through two-thirds of the year, we're at $67.40. So to get to a price high enough where the governor's supplementals are all paid for without a CBR vote, you'd need to get the average price for the year up to something like $80 or $81, which would take a price for the remainder of the year of something like $105 a barrel. We're not at $105 a barrel. Yesterday, we were at like $75 a barrel. So, you know, if prices stay where they are, you could anticipate that deficit would go away, would get smaller. The existing $51.1 million deficit in FY26 could become a small surplus, but barring extraordinary events beyond what we've seen already, I wouldn't anticipate a high likelihood that we will be able to cover all the supplemental requests without tapping the Constitutional Budget Reserve or a similar item. And I have two futures lines on here to show you kind of that comparison. So one is from February 24th, before really the Iran stuff really heated up, and then one is as of yesterday. And you can see that, excuse me, in the short term, the futures market is a lot higher. But by, you know, the end of next fiscal year, they're pretty close. So the futures market has actually come down in the past few days in the second half of the fiscal year 27, as it appears that it's relatively unlikely that the current disruptions are going to continue indefinitely. It is causing the prices to go higher now, but not necessarily lasting into the future. So where does that leave us for FY27? The spring forecast is expected out next Friday, likely based on the futures market as of this week, kind of the average of this week. You know, if you looked at it as of yesterday, or as of today, it's pretty similar. We might be looking at something like a $71 price rather than the $62. So that's a significant difference, $280 million potentially if it's $71, assuming no other changes. But, you know, when you have a $1.6 billion deficit, $280 million of revenue doesn't necessarily change things that much, you know. So you go from a $1.6 billion deficit to a $1.3 billion deficit. It's not a huge change to the in the governor's budget. If you have a lower PFD as well, you know, it would change things a bit, but it's not enough to solve the deficit. And I would note that the trend is downward. So, you know, as much as we can look at today's prices and the futures being higher, the futures market is giving us a lot of reason to believe that we should not bank on that higher price lasting for a long time and dramatically changing our fiscal situation in the long term. And I think that's really the extent of my comments is, you know, on that is just, if you look at the futures market, keep looking down the road, not just at the next few months. And it really is indicating kind of a likelihood that prices will return back to where they were looking a few weeks ago.
Okay. Please continue. No, Representative Galvin, my apologies.
That's okay.
This is the last slide, so we can take just a few moments here. Representative Galvin.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Shragi, through the chair. And I believe you've answered this by saying don't look at the next few months, but I'm still going to ask the question because I want to make sure that the model is already inclusive of some data that I'm sure you're aware of. So we know that this price spike is here. And in addition to that, we know historically that these next few months are when the state of Alaska is producing far more barrels. And so that's kind of a month by month, year longitudinally, we're aware of that. So I just want to double check that your modeling and such is inclusive of that sort of thinking, that when we're seeing a spike, the spike is also happening at the same time that we happen to know that these are the months that we have a spike in production.
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes, that's built into sort of how we in DOR look at it. And I note that the lowest prices we saw were in kind of December, January, which are also high production months. So, you know, the really high prices we saw in July and August, that's a time when we have the lowest production generally. So we didn't get as much benefit from those higher prices at the beginning of the fiscal year. And that is incorporated in how both we and DOR model out the current fiscal year.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Stamp.
All right. Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. Through the chair, Director Painter. All right. So we'll start with 26, kind of a deficit item. Deficit 26, about $51 million according to fall revenue forecasts. What number of oil price from now until the end of the fiscal year, i.e. July 1st, do I need to wipe that out? Through the chair.
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stamp. I think the $51 million deficit is likely wiped out unless prices go down quite a bit, because we're already year to date still above the fall forecast number, and because the anticipation when the fall forecast came out was that prices would be lower in the second half of the year than they were in the first half. That's not what we've seen after that first few weeks. So, you know, I think I haven't done the math to see what you'd need to be $51 million higher, but it would be lower than we're at today for sure.
And follow up, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow up.
Based off the kind of the higher than expected price before we even got to that point, though, it kind of looks like the $51 million is probably not even going to be there. Is that accurate through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, yes. I would anticipate that we may be somewhere, you know, between where we were in the spring revenue forecast last year, which showed a $130 million surplus based on last year's appropriations, and that $51 million will probably be somewhere in between. So some sort of surplus, but not enough to offset those supplementals.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. So what about in the 26 supplemental, talk to me about this kind of disaster number that we're using that's contingent upon not getting basically a higher award than we might get through federal funding through the chair. How much is that?
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So the amount in the bill is $35 million contingent.
Okay.
Follow up, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, follow up. And what is my total number currently on what is expected to be spent? Because I'm looking at Geofonzi, where the disaster money is. I see about there's $120 million on hand there in federal and state money that's being distributed. So kind of what is my current number on disaster that I know up to the end of the fiscal year at this moment through the chair?
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So the size of the current unobligated balance of the fund, of general funds, is something like, it was $5 million. I think it's a little lower now after they've been making some payments. That includes borrowing money from $10 million from DEC capital projects. So it's really at kind of negative five. They've also anticipated an additional $25 million of expenditures for Hai Long, as well as other disasters as well. So the $40 million in the governor's budget was sort of designed to get us back after you repay the $10 million and after you include all these pending costs, get back to about a $5 million balance, which is sort of the margin of error we often have used. That's assuming no more disasters for the year. And that's also assuming that Hai Long, the total costs of that remain at their kind of initial estimate of a roughly $150 million response. I think it's likely to be significantly higher than that. So the $40 million was really premised on a smaller disaster than we likely are facing, but that was how it was calculated, is kind of based on a 25% match, but a smaller disaster than we're likely to get.
Follow up, Mr. Kutcher.
Follow up.
Okay, so no, I agree with you. I think in principle it's going to be higher than that, because I think it's very unrealistic to see that $150 million be the total expense. But we are referencing the 26 supplemental, and most of those expenditures are going to come 27 budget as those kind of numbers continue to roll through on the disaster. So what is the total amount of money for disaster currently in the supplemental budget that's sitting on the Senate floor through the chair?
Director Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, so it's the $40 million plus the $35 million that's contingent. So $75 million total, $35 million of which is contingent.
Follow-up, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, all right. So if I don't have contingency of $35 million and I do not actually have a $51 million deficit, which is also in the bill, what happens to the roughly $80 million in funding that I'm taking out of the CBR through the chair?
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So that would mean instead of a roughly $500 million CBR draw, you'd be looking at, you know, $420 million CBR draw if you pull those two things out. If I did the math right.
Yeah, follow. So they're not pulled out, though, right? So they're going to, let's say the bill, that's how the bill currently sits. It's passed, it's funded with the draw, and the draw exceeds the actual amount of money that you need to pay for things. What happens to the money in FY26? Is that a surplus through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So the CBR language pulls out the amount necessary to make those appropriations. It doesn't pull out a fixed amount. So if we have a surplus, then the amount necessary is less. So, you know, you could imagine a scenario in which instead of a $50 million deficit, we had $100 million surplus and then $400 million of supplementals. You would then need to pull $300 million from the CBR, and that's what that language would do. So it wouldn't pull extra from the CBR out. Even if it did, the Constitution, you know, says that if you owe the CBR money, which we owe about $12 billion, at the end of the year, any balance of the general fund that would remain would just lapse to the CBR. So if that did happen and we pulled extra out, it would just lapse back to the CBR at the end of the year.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yep, Representative Stout.
Thank you. What if I chose not to capitalize disaster relief fund at all in the 27 operating budget? Would the money that's being appropriated to the disaster relief fund through the CBR draw still stay there if I depopulated in 27 operating through the chair?
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, yes. You can sort of move money between the years. Potentially would mean that next year the governor would have to pull from other funds as disasters happen, but that could be done.
Yeah. So last fault, Mr. Crutcher. So obviously I'm going to a place here, and the place is obviously if I do certain things with fund sources and capitalizing them through CBR language, I can kind of undo them if I got a CBR fund this early, right? So you're right that the money wouldn't come out of the CBR if I voted to fund it right now, but I can change that draw after I pass a budget like that if I just uncapitalize certain funds that are being capitalized by the 26 supplemental. Is that correct through the chair?
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, for the something like the disaster relief fund, yes. You know, something like fire suppression, for example, if we don't fund it in FY27, it means that we'll essentially have disasters that'll be declared and more money will be added, but those two funds are kind of special, I suppose, that because they're responding to disasters, the expenditures occur regardless of whether the money is there.
Last one.
Yep. Follow-up, Representative Stapp.
Sounds like another legislator's problem at that point, though, Director Painter. Thanks.
Director Painter.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, many of us will be back next year.
true words from the director. All right. Any additional discussion before we wrap up this presentation? All right. I think, have beat this one up pretty well. Thank you, Director Painter. I am now going to take brief at ease as we prepare the next agenda item. We're at ease.
Okay, going to gavel back in, call House Finance back to order at 2:25 p.m. on Wednesday, March 4th. And next up, we have one bill before the committee this afternoon. That's House Bill 280. That is the digital tax bill. We'll hear a brief explanation of the current special apportionment statutes and codes from the Department of Revenue. Then the department will be available to answer questions regarding the suggested amendment language submitted to the committee from the Alaska Bankers Association, the Motion Picture Association, and the Alaska Telecommunication Industry. These three letters can be found in your packets, and after that, the department will be available for any other questions members might have. Just so folks know, online we do have Brandon Spanos, Acting Tax Director for the Department of Revenue, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist, Michael Williams, Corporate Tax Manager. So with that, I think we are going to have revenue come up, and maybe those are the three people. I don't think we have anybody in the room. They're all online. Okay. So with that, just to kick it off and go over the statutes and codes regarding special apportionments, who would like to start off? Would that be Mr. Spanos? Mr. Spanos, are you there?
Yes. For the record, this is Brandon Spanos, Acting Tax Director in the Department of Revenue, and I'd be happy to start off and talk about the special apportionment rules. So just for a little bit of background, Alaska has a three-factor apportionment formula, which is called the Unified Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, that lives in Alaska Statutes 4319, and we refer to it as UDIPPA. And those three factors for apportionment are property, payroll, and sales. And we look at property and payroll and sales within Alaska over property and payroll of sales everywhere in the U.S., and that's how we get the apportionment factor to calculate how much of the company's income should be apportioned to Alaska. And those three standard factors, they don't always fairly represent how a specific industry conducts business, and so the UDIPPA allows for special rules, and those sometimes show up in statute or in regulation, and I'll go over those special industry rules that we have, both in statute and regulation. The most well-known, I think, is the oil and gas special apportionment. And for oil and gas industry, Alaska has replaced the payroll factor with an extraction factor. So instead of property, payroll, and sales, for oil and gas industry, we use property, sales, and extraction within Alaska over property, sales, and extraction everywhere. And then for transportation carriers, we have the same three factors that we use for all non-oil and gas industries. So that's the common property, payroll, and sales. However, the special rules are related to how we account for mobile property in the factors. So for the airline industry, their mobile property are obviously the planes, and we use ground time to determine how much of the what amount of the property and sales are attributed to the state in the numerator. And then for land transportation carriers, it's terminal time, so time at the terminal loading and unloading. And for water transportation carriers, we use days in port. Public utilities are a little unique in that the statute specifically states that they use the same three factors as everyone else. So the special treatment is that they have standard apportionment. The next industry with alternative apportionment is the construction contractors, and they have the option to choose between two methods of apportionment. One is the percentage of completion method, and the other is the completed contract method. And then lastly, for financial institutions, we have special rules on how intangibles like loans, lease contracts, and credit cards are assigned to the state for property and the sales factor. And that really concludes the overall apportionment. I do have a couple other comments about the general bill that I can talk to as well, or I can wait for questions.
Yes, if you could go ahead and make your comments, your general comments, and then we'll see if there are any questions, and then we'll kind of jump into the substance of, I think, what we want to touch base on, which is the suggested language from the three different industries. So go ahead and make your comments.
Great. So in general, we believe that the language in the bill is enforceable. However, there are some potential unintended consequences of the highly digitized language. And our belief is that the intention was to cast a fairly wide net, but some of the language, or the way that it's written, it basically says that 50% or more of internet sales would be designated as a highly digitized business, which would make a single sale factor. And there are certain industries or business types that would be captured that may not be intended to be captured. So some examples, airlines often almost exclusively have their sales done online. And so since their customers are purchasing tickets electronically, an airline may be designated as a highly digitized business under this bill. Also, similarly, hotels and other travel-related industry have their bookings online. So even though a hotel has a physical presence here and they have property and payroll, those would be thrown out and it would be replaced with sales potentially under this bill. The last few times I've been through a fast food restaurant drive-in, they've asked me, am I using their app for my purchase today? So if more than 50% of their customers are using the app, even though they're physically driving through the drive-through, that could be considered a digital purchase, and therefore they might be a digital business under this bill. Similarly, we looked at just one large retailer and found that 40% of their national sales were done online. And while we didn't look specifically at Alaska or even have that data, it's possible that in Alaska that large retailer would have been more than 50% if they ship a bunch of things online to their to rural customers, which means that even brick-and-mortar stores might be highly digitized under the bill. So one way to ensure that those businesses aren't subject to highly digitized, if that's not the intent of the bill, would be just to specifically name the industries that you don't want to have that industry, that definition apply to, or to somehow other change the language to target the specific industries that you're trying to target in the bill.
Okay, I've got a question from Representative Stapp. Representative Hannah, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair to Mr. Spanos, thanks for being here. So just to kind of be clear, this mechanic, this highly digitized business mechanic that I'm not a fan of, as I've said many times on the record now, if I have a special apportionment for airlines, say, in a state administrative code, and if my airline, you know, I won't name them, but we all know who they are, does a lot of sales online, I would effectively be overriding that and putting them under a single sales factor based on this definition of highly digitized business. Is that correct through the chair?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, with the current language in the bill, I believe that is correct. That's my interpretation, yes.
In fault, Mr. Spanos?
Hello?
Sorry, co-chair. Through the chair to Mr. Spanos. What does that do to their tax obligations? Do we have any idea? Obviously, I can't say taxpayers' names on the record, as we know, but through the chair.
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, it would change it. I can say that definitively, right? Because right now, transportation carriers report property, payroll, and sales in order to portion their income. And so by removing property and payroll from the factors, we would only have one factor left, which would be sales. Whether that would increase or decrease their tax obligation, we'd have to analyze that. We do have Dan Stickel on the line. If he has already analyzed it, he can opine on it. If not, we'd have to get back on whether that is an increase or a decrease anticipated.
Yeah, there's no reason to do that, I think. Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
What about the cruise ships? Do people go on the cruise ships, do they buy tickets online, or do they buy them in Is there like a cruise ship store you can go buy a hand ticket on a cruise ship through the chair?
So through the chair, Representative Stapp, it's been many years since I went on a cruise, but when I went on a cruise, I walked into a physical location and talked to a person and paid with a check over the counter. I doubt that's the way it's done anymore. So if more than 50% of their sales are electronic, which I anticipate that's true, then yes, they would be highly digitized, and the property and payroll, which for cruise ships is far less than airlines, because cruise ships don't have buildings in the state, and they don't have many of them don't have constant. Well, I guess some of them have payroll in the state because they also have buses and other property. So the property that's in the state connected with the cruise ship would be thrown out, the payroll would be thrown out, and we would just be left with sales.
I'll follow up, Mr. Kocher.
Follow up.
What about that weird thing they do with the port call? It's currently in the Ministry of Code, you're talking about they have this special thing with how many hours they're aboard or something. We would effectively be throwing that out, too, in considering them highly digitized businesses. Isn't that correct, through the chair?
So through the chair, Representative Stapp, we would likely reword the regulation. So the regulation would still apply to their sales because we do apportion their sales based on their port time. And so but the property portion of that would be thrown out. So we'd probably just rewrite that regulation to address just sales. However, port time is makes sense for that industry, so we'd probably use port time to attribute sales to Alaska.
Cool. Doesn't sound complicated at all. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Hannon, then Bynum. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. And just my preface, as opposed to my predecessor, I'm a fan of this bill and want to see and make sure we are adding revenue, not losing revenue. So, Mr. Spanos, I want to go to let's do the airline sales first, where we already have an exclusion of special apportionment for them. And are we currently, under property, payroll, and sales, capturing even the digitally sold ticket sales of airlines in Alaska?
So through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes, sales are attributed to Alaska through a special apportionment formula. Which includes ground time.
Okay.
Under current statute.
All right. So if we, I believe I heard you say, if we reference in this bill that we want to basically keep in place the current special apportionment for airlines, hotels, you had land transportation, and then you also had, I believe, water transportation. Do you believe we need to name them individually like that, or just reference the ones that we already have special apportionment rules for taxation? Would you have suggested language on how we'd craft an amendment to make sure that the current taxation structure they're operating under remained in place and wasn't unintendedly captured in the bill that we're working on?
So through the chair, Representative Hannon, I think that with the current special apportionment language that's already in statute and regulation, it would be fairly simple to point to those sections and exclude the exclude those industries from this highly digitized business definition. What would be more difficult are the other entities that I identified that don't have special apportionment. So for like hotels, brick and mortar stores, fast food, those don't have any special apportionment. But just brainstorming, and that's not an all-inclusive list. That was just an internal brainstorm of like what entities might be captured under a 50% or more of a taxpayer sales done online. And that's kind of a short list we came up with. So I suppose one method could be to identify the industries. It's a little bit troublesome to identify like brick and mortar, because you can't discriminate based on the location of the business. So you would have to like name the business. Maybe you would say retail stores and fast food restaurants and try to name all of the entities that you would want to carve out of the highly digitized definition.
Okay. And could I go back to a follow-up?
Representative Hannon.
Mr. Spanos, as you were, thank you, Chair Foster, as you were going through the special apportionment rules and you referenced financial institutions and you started to talk about loans, and, you know, one of the Bankers Association has some recommended amendments to the bill to make sure that they weren't being captured in a way, and I'm curious as to whether their proposed language and our current special apportionment for financial institutions already gives them that protection that they were seeking by an amendment. And so if we, again, went to referencing the existing special apportionment rules, that that protection would already be there.
Mr. Spanos.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's a good question. And the amended language, not only for the financial institutions, but the other two, the telecoms and motion picture, really aren't related to the highly digitized piece. I believe it's more related to the market-based sourcing part of the bill. So the bill does two things. It first goes from cost of performance for sourcing sales to market-based sourcing of sales, and it looks at where your market is for determining where the sales are identified in the numerator. And then secondarily, it also shifts the industry or defines highly digitized businesses and changes to a special apportionment of a single sales factor for that industry. What the amended language is doing is trying to keep the status quo for the market-based sourcing. And the outcome of that would be, if the bill were to pass in its current language with the amendments attached, you would have less tax collections than if you were to leave those amendments out. Our opinion on those three specialized industries is that the Multi-State Tax Commission has model regulation language, and we believe it would be best to address those industries in regulation, and we would start with that model language that already exists with the Multi-State Tax Commission.
Okay, so follow-up, Chair Foster. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Spanos, I'm just going to have you amplify that one more time, that you believe that the three requested amendments to House Bill 280 could be on market-based sourcing, could be dealt with through regulation by using the Multi-State Tax Compact model language.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we would have to follow our regulation statutes, and we would go out for public comment, and it'd be back and forth. But we would look to the model language as a starting point. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, I have Representative Hannon, then Galvin. Representative Hannon, sorry, combine them.
Thank you, Chair Foster, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, Mr. Spanos. Thank you very much for trying to provide all information on such a complicated bill. I think that as we sit here and I listen to some of these explanations, it probably doesn't do justice to try to solve the problem given the complexity of it. Overall, when I sit here and I listen to some of the concerns, I'm thinking to myself, what is the intent of the bill and how do we apply it? And I think one of the things I'm not in favor of is, let's take the legislation and do carve out through the bill on every single industry that may or may not be impacted. It's probably a better course of action to lay out the language of the bill for the exact intention of what the legislature is. And so some of the examples given were there's a brick-and-mortar business in town. The brick-and-mortar business does sales through its website. I can also walk into the store and make the same kind of purchase. But if people are deciding to make those purchases online and going to pick up their item in the brick-and-mortar store, is that considered a highly digitized business? Versus me making those purchases online and having something shipped to my house. I think that it's probably not the intent of wouldn't be my intent that that would be treated as a highly digitized business. I would say that that business is modernizing how they're doing their register system. So is there a way to make a correction in the bill to give intent as opposed to carving out individual industries and or individual industries and or companies?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, that's a very good question, and I will just give the caveat that I am not a drafter. So my input is just from, you know, Brandon Spanos is the acting director. But yes, I think that a starting point, in order to, if the intent is not to capture, brick and mortar stores, for example, a starting point for, would be to move that 50% to something higher. So, the definition is highly digitized. But a 50% threshold doesn't seem like a highly digitized business. That seems like a pretty low threshold. So, you know, pick a number, 75-85% online would seem more in line with what the plain language of highly digitized would mean to most people. And that would be a starting point that would probably exclude the brick and mortar. But the others, I don't know enough about them. Again, I don't need to out that much, but when I do go through a drive-through, I get asked, am I using the app? I assume there's some sort of benefit from using the app. So if most of the customers eventually shift to using the app, a drive-through might have 100% of their sales on the app, even if you're driving through their store. And so by moving that 50% threshold up to 85, you might still capture brick-and-mortar locations in Alaska. I'm not really sure that there's a perfect way to do that through intent. You could also state the intent in the bill and then give us regulatory authority to deal with this with the unintended capturing of into that definition, and we would have to do through a regulation to carve them out.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair, for the opportunity to ask the question. I have many more questions to ask, but not today. I think that probably taking them offline and trying to wrap my head around exactly what our intended goal here is and how to articulate those is something that will take a little bit of time. So thank you for the opportunity to ask the question.
Okay, thank you. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. I appreciate hearing that this giant packet of amendments, and I have two of them, which I think are bigger than the bill itself, could be done in regs. That's important to me. But what I wasn't clear on is if we were to make sure that that happened in that way, Mr. Stanos, through the chair, would you still stand by the revenue impact that I'm looking at in our fiscal note? It looks like a midpoint estimate for highly digitized businesses for this bill is $30 million per year. Would you say that that likely would be where you stood?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes. When we created that fiscal note, our interpretation of highly digitized was that more common. We hadn't really analyzed it enough or to the point where we started considering maybe some brick-and-mortar stores would be included. So our fiscal note only includes what we believe would be highly digitized businesses under the intent as we interpreted it.
A follow-up?
Representative Galvin?
Thank you. So just to be clear, we're still at looking at revenue to the state from $25 to $65 million. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, with the current bill language, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any further? Representative Bynum?
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, so The comment was just made that the revenue projection is based on the current drafting of the bill. I'm still a little confused on how the bill would, who the bill would actually impact. And so I'm not sure how we have a good understanding of what the revenue impact is going to be if we don't have a full understanding of actually who's going to be paying or how people are going to be paying this this tax. So just like a little clarification on what we mean by based on the current drafting of the bill that this would be the revenue projection.
Mr. Spanos, can you elaborate?
So I'll elaborate a little bit, and then I'm going to ask Dan Stickle to speak on it, as he's the one that that did the fiscal, or his team did the fiscal analysis. But to clarify, our interpretation of the bill was that it was intended for highly digitized businesses and not intended to capture brick and mortar stores with a physical presence in the state. And so when we did our analysis, we looked at what we considered to be a highly digitized business and did our fiscal analysis based on that. Now, as we're getting further into, into the weeds of the bill, we start to look at what might the unintended consequences be. And we were specifically asked that question. And so we dug more into it and thought, well, there's one of the unintended consequences are it might capture businesses that we didn't initially think would meet that definition. So now we're questioning that.
Quick follow-up.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So specifically, we're looking in the packet here, and we have some included documentation from the Co-Chair Foster's office, specifically proposed changes for suggestions by the telecom industry or telecommunications industries. Bankers Association recommended changes or suggestions about overall impacts. We've heard about airline agencies and industries that may be impacted, other travel industries that may be impacted. And so when this bill was being, or I'm sorry, when the revenue projection was being created, was it assumed that none of these industries were going to be impacted by the way that they're saying that they potentially would be?
Mr. Spanos, or would you like to go over to Mr. Stickle?
Yeah, we could go to Mr. Stickle for that.
Mr. Stickle, if you could put yourself on the record.
Hey, this is Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue, to Representative Bynum through the chair. So speaking to some of the questions around the revenue estimate, so we have a fairly good handle on the revenue impacts of the market-based sourcing component, and that was roughly $15 million of the overall revenue estimate. The impact of the single sales factor for the highly digitized, that is the primary reason that we put a range of uncertainty around the analysis. When we did the initial analysis, the industries specifically that would be impacted the most by a switch to a single sales factor would be the mining industry, which we do not think would be hit by this bill. And the technology companies and different professional services firms. And so when we did the range of estimates for the fiscal note, we took both a narrow and a broad view of technology companies that might be impacted by the bill, and that kind of led to the range that we put around. So I feel fairly comfortable with the range of estimates that we put around, there is some uncertainty around potential impacts on other industries. The overall analysis that we did shows that switching to the single sales factor on net would have a less revenue impact overall for other industries like the retail industry, although, within those industries there could be definitely positive and negative impacts on specific companies.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. So one of the things that I've been kind of thinking about, I'm in no way a tax expert by any means, but when we look at this bill, we're using this term, the highly digitized, and then trying to quantify what that is and saying that these businesses are doing sales and providing services in Alaska without actually being physically in Alaska. Is there a way to would there be a way to structure this bill where we treat all businesses equally, in the sense that we would look at them and that they're providing a service into Alaska, and then tax them accordingly? And obviously, if they have, you know, people and assets here, that they're, you take that into consideration, as opposed to trying to separate these out into two categories. And if you did do that, what would the impact be?
Mr. Stickle?
Sure, to the chair. So the question is about potential language that would allow for a clearer definition of highly digitized.
Representative Bynum?
Am I understanding that correctly?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. What I'm actually asking is if right now we're looking at this bill and we have one element of the bill is saying we're going to treat businesses with this three apportionment, whether they have personnel and they have assets in the state, and then they're doing business in the state, and then we have what we're categorizing as this highly digitized businesses, which is technically businesses that just are not present in the state, but they're doing business in the state. Is there a way to draft and or look at this where we're treating them all the same, but you're not getting credit for having people here, or you're not getting credit for not having, your business is actually being physically present? Is there a way to structure the bill in such a way that you're not carving out a definition of highly digitized, that you're just basically treating all of the businesses the same that are doing business here, and then giving some level of credit for having actual people here and having actual assets here? Has that been explored, or is that something that other states are doing?
Mr. Stickle?
Sure, to Representative Bynum through the chair, and you know, maybe my boss will want to chime in as well. So the existing three-factor apportionment really kind of does that. Is it gives weight to the property, payroll, and the sales that a company has. And one of the elements of the bill in front of you is the market-based sourcing, which just changes the definition for capturing the sales factor of that apportionment, which would increase revenue from some of these out-of-state technology companies. The decision on whether to carve out a specific set of companies for a single sales factor is, that's a policy call, and that's a decision in front of the committee.
Quick follow-up.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I guess my question is that policy decision of saying carving out highly digitized, what would be the impact of not doing that?
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Representative Bynum through the chair. So in terms of the revenue impacts, we estimate about a $15 million revenue increase to the state from the switch to market-based sourcing for the sales factor. We have a higher level of certainty around that piece of the estimate. And then the estimate for the highly digitized is around $30 million as a midpoint, but with a wider range around that. So if you just did the market-based sourcing, it would be estimated a $15 million revenue increase.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any further questions? Representative Bynum?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. I did have one final question. It has to do with, in the current bill, there is an effective date that is basically passed. And we're saying if this bill was passed today as it is currently written, it's putting a January 1, 2026 effective date. And I'm just trying to get a better understanding of how we would actually be communicating with businesses to tell them, by the way, you have a tax that's due, and it's going to be due starting January 2026, but we don't have any kind of regulatory package in place in order for you to understand how this tax is going to be implemented. Just trying to understand what some of the issues might be with that, as opposed to putting an effective date that's out into the future so that our businesses in the state can actually properly prepare and get ready for a potential new tax or a modernization of a tax.
Mr. Stickle or any of the other two folks online? Mr. Stickle?
Sure, I'll be happy to take a first stab at it. This is Dan Stickle again for the record. So for the implementation, we would do a fast-track regulations package to have those regulations targeted by January 1st of 2027, and that would give adequate time for taxpayers who will be preparing their 2026 tax returns in early 2027. So that's how we would address that, and we're happy to administer whichever, if the committee wants to go with the 2026 date or another start date, if making it effective 1/1/27, we're happy to administer either way.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So doing some kind of a fast-track regulatory package for this, how does this allow appropriate time for businesses to properly adjust and coordinate and respond to you trying to put together a regulatory package for a tax that would have already been required? I'm just trying to get a better understanding of how we can be fair dealers with businesses that are actually doing business in Alaska. And I believe that trying to put a retroactive tax in place for a business that doesn't understand what that tax currently is probably problematic at best.
Mr. Stickle?
Yeah, Representative Bynum through the chair. So that's a good observation. You know, companies have already done activity and made plans based on the current tax code for 2026. From an administrative standpoint, it would be ideal to have the date moved out, but we're happy to, administer whichever policy decision the legislature gives us. And I should note, it sounds like our acting director is muted, so he may have some additional comments.
And I'll just throw in my two cents. I'm not a fan of making that retroactive for the points I think Representative Bynum are making, which is for folks to try to figure out what's going on and then retroactively calculate taxes going back. It's not ideal. So I certainly would support that. Mr. Spanos, do you have any questions or comments on that? And then we'll go to Representative Shragi. Mr. Spanos?
Am I unmuted?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. no, I'm leaving to add, Dan did a great job.
Thank you.
Representative Shragi?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I just wanted to note that, I too have some concern about businesses being able to respond accordingly, but I would also note that the businesses that are that would be included or covered under this bill are C corporations and largely large institutions with very sophisticated financial knowledge, monitoring abilities, and would likely be able to respond fairly nimbly to any changes like this. So I think the concern is valid, but also I think these are not your mom-and-pop businesses that you're going to find in your local community. These are the big C-suite companies that have very sophisticated operations. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any questions right off the bat. So kind of the focus of what we wanted to do at this meeting was to address the three proposed amendments. And I was thinking that we were going to maybe get into the nuts and bolts of how they worked, what exactly the Department of Revenue's response was to those. I sense that it's more of a generalized answer, which is they recommend that it would be done by regulation. So that's kind of my takeaway at this point, but I just wanted to check with folks to see if anyone had any questions specifically on anything in those proposed amendments. Any questions for revenue while we have them? Representative Galvin?
Yes, thank you. My primary question really is just if we were to put these suggested amendments into regulation, again, back to, is it going to change our bottom dollar? What is it? How is it going to change, if any, what you have already placed in the fiscal notes?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the regulations that we would adopt would be in conformance with the statute, and we believe that market-based sourcing would apply to all three of those industries. And so, no, it wouldn't change the bottom dollar if you were to do it through regulation.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I know that there are folks who are interested in seeing the language in the bill, and I just am, I don't know, I'm looking at my staff and trying to figure out, we want to make sure that we're incorporating all of the perspectives and I know that we're going to have more meetings on this. And so with that, maybe, Mr. Anderson, in terms of the next steps, if you wouldn't mind coming up and just put yourself on the record, I don't know if we have any content experts with regard to the three proposed amendments that we wanted to have speak to those in terms of just pointing out anything that might need to be pointed out. I know that we do have the avenue of possibly going down the regulatory route, but Mr. Anderson, thoughts?
Through the chair, for the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Foster. Where the committee is at today at the conclusion of this meeting would be the possibility of having invited testimony come up like we had with the Motion Picture Association to have the other two industries have experts from their side present on invited testimony to hear their side of it versus what we heard from the department today. Once we get through that point of invited testimony, if the committee wants to go in that direction, is the next steps are the possibility of creating a CS of the points that there's general consensus on, if there is any, on a possible CS, and or then moving to the amendment process and conversations that individual offices would have with both Department of Revenue and also with industry on how to change some of the things that we've heard today, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so I think what the plan might be, and I'm certainly open to suggestions, but what I think we'll do is maybe at our next meeting we'll have invited testimony, and I know that Motion Picture had folks online, but if there's anything else they wanted to add, I'd certainly allow that at the next meeting, and then we can maybe have a finer plan on exactly what we want to do next, whether we want to go to amendments, do a CS, move the bill out, set it aside. We'll figure that out. So, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I appreciate that idea. I think it's a good idea. I would just request that if we're going to have that opportunity where we're going to have these invited testimony, that we understand who those folks are going to be and that we would make sure that we're reaching out to some of those other industries, for example, probably air carriers and travelers and folks like that, to get a better understanding from them what they think that the impacts potentially are going to be. I'd appreciate that and that we would know that ahead of time.
It's a good idea. Thank you. Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd take a slightly different view than Representative Bynum, and that is I would ask that the invited testimony make sure that they've listened to the Department of Revenue suggestion. I think especially in an area of tax law where we have specific details and experts giving us guidance of here's some advice for unintended consequences, here's some areas where we already have special apportionment rules, and it doesn't seem like our intent was to undo all those. So, you know, the airline industry, for example, where we already have special apportionment rules, and in my mind, that wasn't the intent of this bill to change, upset that apple cart, that's working fine. We're capturing taxes on that industry already by describing highly digitized. We aren't intending to redo that tax structure, at least That's not my perception of what this bill was attempting to do. So I don't know that we need them and their tax advisors to come here and reaffirm what I heard from our guidance from Department of Revenue, that unless we are intending to undo that, we've already got a system in place. I heard some very specific things from the Department of Revenue, like we need to perhaps change our definition of the percentage level of highly digitized, that unless we thought that our special apportionment rules that we exist aren't working for us, and I've never heard that, they seem to be in place, we're collecting those taxes, let's go there. When three industries we've not got apportionment special rules for are saying our concern of you capturing us in a way under highly digitized that you've never done before, but our department saying other states do and there's model language looking to do that in regulation versus us trying to craft a 90-page bill to capture it in the details, to me does not seem the best use of writing statute, because that really should rest with our department that we give expertise to make sure that they're capturing taxes in the way that our intent was. I don't mind hearing from them, but I would ask that those invited guests don't start with the original draft as the version, but hear the guidance from the Department of Revenue and trust that we're listening to that as ways to move this bill forward, because, as I said previously, I believe that we should be moving on highly digitized businesses that are currently not captured under our tax law, and that we should attempt to get our fair share, because they're being taxed in other jurisdictions for business that they're doing in Alaska. Now, understanding, they've pointed out some very, you know, revenue saying some unintended consequences, so let's look at the modernization where everything is done digitally from your order at the restaurant to the drive-through, because I don't think that was our intention, but we need to make sure we've got definitions in the bill that address that, and I just don't want to start over with them dealing with the original version as the only potential that we're working from. The retroactivity clause, also one of those places where I hear members saying they've got big problems with that. So that's one of those places we want to craft a bill that makes us all comfortable going forward and has the intention of generating new revenue to the state, not cutting off revenue we're already capturing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I enjoy having these discussions because we're getting all the ideas out on the table, And so Mr. Anderson and I can figure out our path forward here, but it's good to get all the perspectives. I've got Representative Shragi and then Bynum.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And sorry if this has already been covered before. These are complex issues, and the meetings all seem to kind of blend together a little bit. You know, I was listening to, I think it was Director Spanos earlier, talk about some of the businesses that could potentially get caught up in this highly digitized definition that's been outlined today, and I heard quite a few, some of which were surprising to me. I think maybe the most surprising to me was, your fast food restaurant that makes a sale through the app, and that got me thinking back to thinking about this highly digitized business definition that we're using in this bill, and the fact that we use internet sales and internet elsewhere in here, and that got me to thinking. I pulled my dictionary here on what is the definition of the internet, and it's, according to Legal Dictionary, it's very broad, and I'm now thinking, are iPad sales at my local coffee shop now included in this? It seems like a very broad definition that could unintentionally encapsulate or capture a whole host of businesses that I don't believe are intended to be captured under this highly digitized business definition. I contrast that with the document I've received from the Multi-State Tax Compact Organization, and you know they've been capturing these internet sales through a completely different methodology. Are there concerns around the use of the definition of internet under the highly digitized business? Could I get the one of our invited testifiers to just provide some perspective on that and whether that creates challenges and some of the ambiguity in the bill.
Mr. Spanos, would that be a question for you?
Sure, I'll take a stab at that, Mr. Chair. So the term internet in the language, one of the concerns that someone internally has is that there's an Internet Freedom Act, and it's probably best not to use the word internet in the bill, which would, again, our analysis is that we could implement administer this bill as written, but someone may challenge that word internet as impeding on the Internet Freedom Act. And so probably it's better to define it a little bit differently, like a digital sale or, the sale of digital goods, something along those lines rather than the word internet. And then, of course, defining what a digital sale and digital good are, we always love definitions as tax administrators because that gives us the ability to say that something is either part of that definition or not, rather than trying to, figure it out on the fly. And so there was two parts. The other part was that the Multi-State Tax Commission has a different definition. That is part of this bill. So the Multi-State Tax Commission compacts, they have shifted to market-based sourcing. Most states have gone to market-based sourcing. That does capture sales from highly digitized businesses. And by highly digitized businesses, I don't mean the definition of bill. I mean technology industry. So streaming services, online sales, all the things that we consider digital goods, those are all captured in the sales factor under the market-based sourcing portion of this bill. And so the highly digitized piece is a second component. You can almost think about them as two separate animals, right? The one is modernizing our corporate income taxes to consider sales that are taking place through digital services as happening in Alaska when the market or the customer is in Alaska. And so that's happening with this, and that's what the Multi-State Tax Compact, most states are moving to. And then, of course, the second piece, the highly digitized, is completely separate and is not really connected to that first piece. They're just in the same bill.
Representative Sharkey?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. That's very helpful. Director Spanos, it's a little bit muffled coming through the line, and I just wanted to ask for clarification on one part. Did you say that part of the concern relates to an Internet Freedom Act, or what was the reference you made there? It wasn't clear coming through the line.
Mr. Spanos?
Sure. Again, through the chair, Representative Schrage, the Internet Freedom Act is a federal act that basically says you can't tax the use of the Internet.
I see.
And so the Multi-State Tax Commission has suggested that states not use that word Internet in their statutes because it might look like it's impeding on that Internet Freedom Act. But again, we don't believe this does that because the even though it uses the word internet, it's not taxing the use of the internet. It's taxing sales that are happening on the internet. So, but again, probably best not to use the word. It's probably best to define it as a sale of a digital good or service.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I appreciate it.
Okay. Next question, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. I'm not exactly sure who might be able to answer this, but maybe something to consider. We've talked a little bit about unintended consequences and or intended consequences, and one of the things that comes to mind that I don't know I've heard an answer on has to do when we talk about highly digitized, that in this modern era of using technology that we do have delivery of services via electronic devices and the internet and other ways. But we have millions of visitors that come to our state every year, and they may be engaged in commerce using their devices in the state. And so I'm not sure if that this bill is intended to capture those sales when they're happening, even though that person is not a resident, but using and or benefiting from a digital service that's being provided. So I think that's something else I think we'd like to, I would like to see an exploration on and see how that would be impacted in this bill. Because if we're talking about economic uses of digitized businesses and benefits or services being provided, I'd like to know that those are being equally distributed to visitors and residents alike.
Mr. Anderson, I don't know if you've got any just general comments for now or anybody online.
Through the chair, I would definitely defer to the Department of Revenue for any answer on that.
Okay. And I realize that this is probably more of a intent question from the sponsor of the bill and not so much the department. So, but I just maybe I will reach out to the Department of Revenue just to see if you've got any general thoughts, not expecting an answer, but want to give you the opportunity.
So through the chair, Representative Bynum, yeah, that's something that we would want to maybe look at a bit more. I can tell you under current statute, we use cost of performance. And so under the current statute, we wouldn't look to where the customer is or, you know, if that customer is a resident or not a resident or a visitor. We look at where the cost of the sale was. And that's why a lot of technology companies don't report sales to Alaska because their costs, they don't have any physical presence in Alaska, their cost centers are outside of Alaska, and so they're reporting the sales to another state. And so the market-based sourcing piece of this bill would capture those sales in Alaska, but as it pertains to a visitor, again, probably best to do a little bit of homework. I could ask Mike Williams to speak to that if you want an answer now. On how we might treat that if the bill were to pass. But I'd have to think about it a bit more.
Yeah.
Let me check with Representative Bynum and just see if you had a clarifying, or is it a separate question?
No, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I don't need an answer today, but it's just something to think about that it would like to see if we can get a response on it at some point.
Sounds real good. Thank you. Okay, well, tax bills are certainly complex, and we'll keep at it. So with that, if there are no other questions or comments, we will have another meeting on this. So our next scheduled meeting is for tomorrow, March 5th at 1:30 p.m., and at that meeting we'll hear an overview from the Department of Corrections and a presentation from the Department of Health on SNAP and Medicaid implementation from our federal legislations, H.R. 1. So if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:22 p.m. Thank you.